And now we present to you Thacko with Advantage.
Welcome to Thacko with Advantage. We're two friends that have been playing D&D a long time. While we both love lots of other RPGs, D&D is the five-page backstory we wrote for our characters. Hi, I'm Ange, and I've been gaming for over 35 years. In 2014, I started writing for Gnome Stew, and I've been running the Gnomecast, the Stew's podcast, since 2017. In 2021, I became head gnome.
And I'm Jared. I'm the review gnome at Gnome Stew, and I've seen 7 editions of D&D, depending on how you count them. In addition to writing reviews at Gnome Stew, I've got my own site, whatdoinojr.com, where I write additional reviews and opinion pieces on a variety of RPGs. After we look at the games we're running in the campaign journal, or not, we'll be talking about backgrounds, how they're integrated into D&D, what they mean, and what they could mean. Then we'll have some recommendations of D&D-related content for you to check out in our downtime research segment.
Now stand by for station identification. This is WDND The Role Player. Now we're going to McElroy McKinney and the Bardic College.
From the Bardic College. Now, kits were a concept from AD&D 2nd Edition that modified a character class by giving it some minor abilities and a few extra proficiencies. The first appearance of kits was in the Time of the Dragon box set, where they were used to portray the standard abilities that people from different cultures would have. Now, these weren't broad concepts, but more setting-specific, like Minotaur Legionnaire, or Gnomish Companion of the Dead. I mean, come on, if you're an undead gnomish necromancer, you would raise yourself some human skeletons too to carry you around. Sounds like a great way to get around that 25-foot movement speed thing. In this version of kits, you had to pay back the extra proficiencies you got at first level. It's kind of like taking out a loan. This also meant that by the time you reached a specific level, you had the same number of proficiencies that anyone of that class would have. It just gave you a bunch of power previous to them, which seems a little bit broken to me. Oh, we'll get to that in a second, though. Now, kits continued on to the PHBR series with PHBR-1, The Complete Fighter. Some kits, like the Swashbuckler, opened up new abilities and playstyles, and others just penalized you for fun, like the Barbarian. See video on breaking magic items. Now, as we move along, we get the Complete Book of Elves. At this point, kits were just starting to add things to make characters better than they were without kits, and some much more so than others. Now, let me tell you, TSR, they tried desperately to get that kid horse back in the barn with player's option skills and powers. That's where kits were a minor add-on at the end of character creation. It also bundled some abilities slightly cheaper when taken as part of the kit rather than if purchased otherwise. That meant that Skills and Powers is trying to get that power creep under control before it introduced its own power creep. Plus, Skills and Powers with the power became the power that powered 3rd edition. Just saying. Power to the D&D.
Let me just finish up this campaign journal.
So, I wasn't supposed to play this past weekend, which would have made our campaign journal extremely barren. I was supposed to be in Cleveland visiting friends and getting to go to the Cleveland Museum of Art and the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but I got just enough of a cold before the trip that I ended up canceling. In the before times, this was the type of thing I would have just powered through and probably gotten myself more sick. But the world has kind of changed a little. Since I did have to cancel, I was available to play our Cygnus de Gore campaign, which is something we do virtually, so my virus is not going to infect anyone else, except the people that live in my house, but thankfully that didn't happen.
Yay.
It was a nice consolation prize. So the last session of the campaign was a running battle that had us just fighting all of the bad guys in the place until we finally took them out and the remaining mercenaries all surrendered. This session had pretty much no combat at all. We were basically role-playing through cleanup and figuring out what was going on that we hadn't already figured out. As I said, some of the mercenaries had surrendered, so we ended up having a conversation with them to figure out what was going on. From them, we found out that Aminta, who I think was a cleric, and her wizard buddy had been working for someone else and were trying to mine this giant statue for powered stone or something. It's a wizard did it. And they were doing this regardless of the fact that harming the statue was causing earthquakes and endangering the entire region, including the village that was up above. There was also something about drow You know, I was like, what? Okay, fine. Malcolm ended up giving them some gold and telling them to go on about their way and get lost. We also discovered that there was a halfling who was kind of mixed in among the mercenaries who was acting a little bit differently. Malcolm and half the party went to talk to him and ended up finding out he was a spy for the other side of this drow war in the Underdark. Apparently there's some sort of conflict happening between the drow and some minotaurs, and Aminta and her wizard buddy were basically trying to supply the drow with resources. He was working for the minotaurs, trying to figure out what was going on and maybe sabotage their operation a little bit. Meanwhile, Selena, my character, went with the rest of the party to talk to the villagers that had all been, quote-unquote, hired to work as miners in these catacombs. They were treated very poorly. They'd never actually received any payment. It wasn't quite slavery, but it was not a pleasant situation for them. Selena let them know they'd all been misled and gave each of them a platinum and told them to go home to their families. It is very nice to be a wealthy adventurer who can hand out 20 platinum without thinking about it twice. After all of that, we ended up putting the cursed shard that led us here in the first place into the statue, which instantly healed itself completely, even though there was other material missing. Apparently that shard was a special piece. And we got a vision of the history of the place, including the fact that the giant statue is actually some sort of giant or titan who sacrificed himself to stabilize the region and had stood guard for millennia. And then we got a vision of an adventuring party who came through and helped save the day once again a few centuries passed. And then we got a vision of some adventurers that kind of look like ourselves saving the day yet again. After that, we started poking around a little more and we learned that Aminta had basically sacrificed her boyfriend from the village to create a portal between this catacomb and the Underdark where they were sending their supplies. His soul was kind of trapped in this bottle to make him serve as a portal between the two places. We had a conversation with him and asked him to, you know, let him know we were going to release him, but we needed to figure out what was going on in the Underdark first. So we ended with us entering the Underdark, ready to go exploring for some more adventure and stop some more bad people. I talked with Scott, the GM of that campaign, because he's been running this campaign for close to 2 years. I felt a little bad. He's never complained, but I always want those forever GMs to also get a chance to play. And so I offered to run a Tales of the Valiant campaign when we wrap up this current part of the storyline. He says we've got maybe 3 or 4 sessions left, which will probably take us closer to the holidays, which will make timing a lot more crazy. So more than likely, I'm going to be starting a Tales of the Valiant campaign for this group starting in January with maybe a session zero beforehand.
That sounds like a next year game now after that.
Yeah. I may be getting myself in trouble because I also told the other Saturday group that when Tristan wraps up the City of Cowls game, I'll pick up the Depths of Zendrick game. It could work out to be timing that I end up running both Saturday games at the same time. I don't think so, because Les, who has never GM'd before, has offered to try and run for us. They have an idea about basically a mashup of Pugmire in D&D. I mean, Pugmire is kind of D&D already. The vision is that we are all playing small cats and dogs. Not sexy, furry tabaxi, but little cats and dogs. And most of us are basing these on our household pets. So it should be a fun time. And I'm excited to see Les get their feet wet running a game for the first time.
Was this the Shape Changer campaign or was that a different?
Yes. we found two doppelgangers that look like Aminta, the woman in charge, and we were like, what the heck is going on? But we hadn't killed them, so they didn't revert to doppelganger form, and one of our more morally gray companions went and quietly took care of the unconscious and bound doppelgangers while the rest of us were doing some stuff.
I was going to say there for a while, it sounded like an analogy for magical fracking with the statue there.
Yeah, very much so. Magical fracking. I like that.
I think I know what anthology adventure that is, or at least part of what it's based on, because it started sounding a little more familiar towards the end.
Yeah, I think most of what Scott's running are adventures from Keys of the Golden Vault.
Yeah.
Maybe with a little bit of other stuff mixed in there. And as a result, I have not been looking at my Keys of the Golden Vault book. Because the funny thing is not this year, but the previous year, Scott and I basically each bought the Keys to the Golden Vault as quote unquote birthday presents for each other. We basically bought them for ourselves, but told each other, I'm buying you this.
We buy this at the same time. It's for each other.
Yeah. Yeah.
We have nothing to see here. We didn't play, and my Saturday groups weren't playing, but this Saturday, we have a Tales of the Valiant campaign that we're starting up. It's going to be monthly, where we're just kind of giving the rules a test run, and we're going to be using the Thrones and Bones setting for that, and I'm looking forward to it, and I've been doing a lot of work in Shard to get that set up. And then the weekend after this one is when I run Curse of Strahd, and I have some exciting news about it, but I can't say it on the off chance that one of my players ends up listening to this. And that's all I have this time.
We shall have to wait.
Yeah.
Welcome to the Dungeon Master's Workshop.
Moving into the Dungeon Master's Workshop, as players, we're always thinking about the backstories of our characters, but how that is handled in the mechanics of the game system has changed over the years. In the early days of D&D, this was usually limited to the expected tropes of the species and classes you took, with maybe a teeny tiny influence from the setting. You really couldn't deviate too far from the path that your species and class set you on. But then, with the advent of 5th edition, D&D introduced backgrounds as a formal aspect of our characters. And now, with the arrival of the 2024 version, backgrounds have gained even more weight. So, let's discuss. So let's take a moment and talk about the importance or lack thereof of a character's backstory in a fantasy game.
So a lot of what your character is going to do and how they are positioned with the societies that you have in your setting is going to be based on their backgrounds. And we know this from archetypical characters. For example, Conan was like always an outsider when he would go into civilized places because he was a Sumerian barbarian, and on one hand, people would look down on him, but then they would also underestimate him, and they would hire him to do things that nobody from their society would be willing to do. So that was something that his background really played into there. King Arthur, that's a whole different story, because you're not going to have King Arthur doing the same kinds of storylines that you did with Conan, because here is somebody that is trying to, you know, fight off invaders to the country and unify everybody under his banner.
But technically, both of them would probably have been built as fighters.
Exactly. And even more, like, when you look at some other examples, like Baffert and Mauser, Baffert would be a fighter, probably, and Mauser, sort of, he should be a thief, but they should both be thieves, but he's really good at dueling, so he should be a fighter. So, you see, you know, we get some confusing stuff here with backgrounds. Also, I think The Lord of the Rings is a big one to show what your background is going to contribute to how you participate in the story. Aragorn's whole deal was that he was denying his destiny until the end of the story. The other thing that's kind of interesting is people think that elves and dwarves in general didn't like each other in Middle-earth, but it was actually very specifically the Sylvan elves that Legolas was from that didn't get along with the elves because of that whole thing about the treasure and Thranduil keeping that. That wasn't a problem they had with like Galadriel or anything. That was a problem they had with the Sylvan elves. So that's another situation where it's the background that kind of mattered there.
Like I said, we've all created backstories for our characters, but, you know, a lot of it didn't necessarily make it into play.
Mm-hmm.
It really depended upon the GM, how much attention they would pay to their characters' backstories. And I've played a lot of D&D games where the character's backstory didn't matter. It was just kind of ignored. And if you wrote that 5-page backstory, do not write a 5-page backstory unless you just want to do some creative writing.
Learn bullet points.
If you wrote that backstory, it only mattered if the GM played into it. I mean, it could definitely flavor how you played your character, but there was no real, you know, mechanical purpose for a backstory for characters in our D&D games.
Yeah, and it makes sense if you look at the very beginning of the hobby, because the very beginning of the hobby was you are going into the dungeon to fight monsters and spring traps and get treasure, and the town is where you go to sell stuff and rest up between going back into that dungeon. And your background really probably didn't matter a whole lot in that situation.
Yeah, and I mean, even further back in the hobby, it came out of wargaming. Rather than running an army, you were running a hero. The narrative aspects of role-playing games has definitely evolved over the years. It's, for me, it has always been about the story.
Mm-hmm.
Always been about the story. And, you know, I will confess, I have been one of those players who wrote a 5 or more page backstory because I got excited about the character. Over the years, I kind of held back from that because nothing broke my heart more than putting a lot of effort into creating a character's backstory and either having the GM completely ignore it or having the character never played because the game died before we ever picked up our dice. It's all there in how we think about our characters.
Yeah.
Were there any aspects of older editions that gave mechanical weight to a character's background?
There was certainly some stuff that existed, whether it worked really well or not. First edition Unearthed Arcana had a table that it introduced where you would roll on the table and it would tell you your social class and it would go from lower class to upper class. Now, that's barely a background. You know, it does tell you a little something about your character, but it's not really a full background. But in true first edition style, this table was used to further punish players for rolling badly about something because they assigned like a minimum status that you could be for different classes. So if you rolled lower class, you were only allowed to be a thief or an assassin if you were using these status rules. And you had to at least be lower upper class to be a cavalier. And Unearthed Arcana made paladins a subclass of cavalier, which meant to be a paladin, not only did you have to roll cheat-worthy dice in order to get your ability scores that high, but you also had to make sure that you rolled lower upper class or higher for your status.
Oh, no wonder nobody ever used that. I mean, it was hard enough in first and second edition to get your stats to be where you wanted them to be.
Uh-huh.
So then having to roll on another table,
yeah,
that might tell you you're not allowed to be what you want to be.
It was rough. I want to say that some of the Beckme, the gazetteers that they did for basic and all of that D&D had some background-ish things in them, because they did do a lot of kind of experimental stuff, you know, with the gazetteers, like they introduced specific classes just for halflings or just for dwarves and things like that in those books. But because I moved off of that train to get fully into advanced D&D, I can't speak to that as well. Second edition made a little bit better motion towards this. And part of that was because second edition adopted non-weapon proficiencies, which first showed up in the Dungeoneer Survival Guide and the Wilderness Survival Guide, and said, this is part of the game now.
Non-weapon proficiencies, proto-skills.
Yes. Where you would have to roll under your ability score, which is odd because it actually gave you a use for ability score other than generating your bonus. But a system that they had along with introducing non-weapon proficiencies was to say, if you don't want to go through and pick individual non-weapon proficiencies, you can roll on this chart and see what your background is. That background gave you a profession, and then right behind that profession, it basically told you what proficiencies that gave you.
That sounds familiar.
Yeah. So like if you rolled Teamster Freighter, you would get the ability to repair weapons and animal handling. That was a little bit nicer because getting the name of a profession kind of implied that you did something before you were an adventurer.
Yeah.
And at the very least, maybe you were trained by, you know, your parents to do this thing, even if you didn't ever actually do it as a profession. But then second edition also had kits, and kits are weird because kits are a precursor to a lot of things because they're sort of a precursor to backgrounds, but they're also kind of a precursor to prestige classes and subclasses because they are this way that you specialized your character. And depending on the individual kit, it might be more about specializing you because of your culture or specializing you because of your fighting style or your spellcasting style or something like that.
I didn't play with kits at all. I grew frustrated with second edition, so I had kind of wandered away around the time I think kits were being made, you know, basically added to the game. So I know of them, but I never really played with them.
If you weren't frustrated before kits, you may have been frustrated after kits. Early on, like the very first kits are definitely much more like backgrounds because they showed up in the Time of the Dragon box set for Dragonlance, and they were basically very specific things. This was things like, you are a Minotaur Legionnaire, so therefore you have these proficiencies and you have this extra ability. So that's talking about like a job within a specific society. And the way those worked was, if you got all these proficiencies at first level, because that's what you would know as someone in that culture, you still had to pay them back. So like by the time you reach like seventh level, if you got two more proficiencies, you had to pay for those proficiencies that you front loaded with that kit. You were getting stuff early, but you weren't getting extra stuff, assuming that you actually survived to reach those levels.
Which was in question in second edition.
Yes. By the time we got to the PHBR books, which is like the Complete Fighter, Complete Thief, all of those, it changed a little bit, and then it changed a lot. Because the very early books had these things where it was the kit would give you something and then take something away from the class. If you are a swashbuckling fighter, you would get a bonus to your armor class as long as you were holding dueling weapons. But you couldn't wear heavy armor anymore. So it was kind of that trade-off where it's like, okay, I envision myself, you know, fighting with a rapier, but also I'm not going to wear plate armor. So my armor class will never be super great, but it can be better because I know how to defend myself using the sword to parry. Now, by the end of the kit series, with things like the Complete Book of Elves, those kits were just kind of like, hey, would you like to be a fighter mage and also do extra awesome stuff?
There's a little, what do they call it? Feature creep?
Yeah, yeah. It drifted quite a bit there towards the end. They were forgetting to maybe take something away from the class, too. The funniest thing was that kind of towards, not really towards the end, it was kind of in the middle of second edition when the player's options books and all of those came out, they sort of tried to rein kits back in because the point by character creation in the skills and powers book, kits were a thing that you could buy at the end of your character creation that just kind of like bundled some abilities together that you could buy separately, but they were cheaper if you bought them in the kit bundle. That probably would have been better, but I don't think a lot of people did that.
I think it's important to note that during the second edition era was when TSR was struggling and kind of dying, and there was a lot of chaos in the company and in the design of the game.
Yeah,
as it marched its way through the 1990s. I do know with third edition, not really backgrounds, but you could definitely tailor your character to an idea more with, one, the freedom of species and class that third edition brought to the table.
Yep.
With the skills you could choose, because, yeah, you were limited in certain skills you could pick based on your class, but it's still, you had a little more freedom. And with feats, because there were quite a few feats that you had to take at character creation.
Mm-hmm.
In some ways, these are, you know, they were definitely not backgrounds, but they definitely kind of added to your concept of who the character was as you were creating them to play at the table. Some of them were tied to what species you were. Some of them were tied to what class you were. But like I said, there were a bunch that were, you must take this at first level.
Yeah.
You know, at character creation.
And I know, like in the Forgotten Realms books, there were specific regional feats. So in other words, like you had, if your character was from the Dale Lands, you could take this feat and it would make you better at something that someone from the Dale Lands could do. It sort of served a little bit as a background in that case, because it was saying, hey, because you're from here, you're eligible to be better at this thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they did that with Eberron at any point in time.
Eberron had the, you had the dragon marks.
Mm-hmm.
And the dragon marks would specifically tie you to a dragon marked house.
Yeah.
Which could create some interesting background connections for that character.
Yeah, and that's interesting because it wasn't, everyone wouldn't necessarily have one, but that did imply a certain background if you took a dragon mark.
Or if you took the aberrant dragon mark, you basically were kind of, you hid that from people because you didn't want anyone to know you had it.
Yeah.
You were somebody who would have been shunned by one of the dragon mark families, if not hunted.
And then fourth edition had, they weren't backgrounds, but I think they're playing in the same space, because you had your paragon paths, which were kind of a specialization to what you did. And then you had your epic destinies, which was kind of like the big archetype that you were heading towards. By the time you reach 30th level, you are going to be this thing because it's your destiny. And they were kind of like big concept things, like demigod was like one of the epic destinies. It's weird because, like I said, it's not really background, but it is giving your character a little bit more detail as far as like your goals and how you accomplish things.
It's changing a character's flavor.
Yeah.
I sort of mentioned this already, but with the advent of third edition opening up class restrictions, how did that help with the variety and types of characters people could play?
It really made it to where you could picture a lot of different things that were still in the theme of that race's culture, but with completely new horizons. You could have your dwarven diviners that advise the king, or your dwarven evokers that were, you know, war mages. You could have elves that belong to a specific, you know, religious order where they would meditate and learn martial arts and become monks.
Yeah.
You could have forest gnomes that weren't friendly with people and became barbarians.
The very first D&D game I ever ran was a one-shot, and I made characters specifically based on going against the tropes, so to speak. So I had a halfling barbarian who was married to a gnome druid. We had a dwarf fighter who was a wizard evoker. I described him as having his beard constantly singed. I had a half-orc bard and his brother, the half-elf cleric. That's a trope I've enjoyed playing with in other games. And then there was, I made the elf a thief, because I, you know, play against that trope of elves being noble and above the din of society. No, this guy likes stealing your purse. And then I had the human fighter, just because I didn't know what else to do with the fighter.
Okay, they did that for the iconic characters for third edition, too. Like, what do we do for... Okay, we have a dwarf fighter, but we also just have to have a human fighter, because that's just the most plain concept we could come up with.
The most vanilla character you could come up with.
And they proceeded to have horrible things happen to the human fighter in almost all the artwork. If you go through third edition artwork, the human fighter is like the one that's always like lying on the ground needing to be healed, or the one that got killed by something.
While they did open up these options, there was still a little bit of a push towards optimal choices. Because your stat bumps came from your race, or your species as we call it nowadays, you kind of wanted to choose certain ones to play certain classes, because that could get you the stats you needed to make that class completely viable.
You could be the dwarven diviner. You probably weren't going to be a dwarven sorcerer, because they took a penalty to charisma, unless you really wanted to fight against that upstream.
Yeah, I know in general, I loved the fact that third edition, I mean, it's honestly what saved D&D for me, or brought it back to life, however you want to whatever metaphor I want to use for this. As I said, second edition, I was burnt out. I didn't want to play exactly the same thing over and over again. And none of the folks I played with, we didn't have long-running campaigns. So it was like we'd make a character, play for a little while, I'd get invested in that character, and then never get to play them again.
Yeah.
We're going to make another campaign, and, well, I already used the ideas for a character, and, like, I can't see this character being any different than the last one I played like this. And with third edition kind of taking the shackles off of those things, it allowed for different ideas. I didn't get to play her nearly as much as I wanted, but one of my favorite third edition characters was a tiefling ranger.
Mm-hmm.
Take a tiefling and drop him in the woods.
If you can have a tiefling druid in the D&D movie.
Let's take a moment and talk about that. We're going to get into fifth edition backgrounds in a moment, but I think it's important to talk about there was a lot of peer pressure in D&D third edition and before to stay within certain tropes.
Yeah.
Like, I know a lot of old guard players who would get very like, oh, what are you doing with this? You can't play a character that's like that. The idea of the tiefling druid would be like, oh, that doesn't make any sense. You can't play that.
Mm-hmm.
Third edition into fourth edition, and definitely with the dawn of fifth edition and bringing in a whole lot of new players with Critical Role and things like that, people just like, I'm going to play what I think sounds cool, you know, but I've told this story before. I was afraid to play an elf because there was a speciesist player in that first D&D game I played who, like, only he was allowed to play elves because only he could properly play them correctly.
Yeah, there was a lot of that thinking at one point in time. That wasn't great. The other thing that's really weird about third edition is that, like with kits, prestige classes could sort of be a background, too.
Mm-hmm.
There were some prestige classes that were just kind of like job oriented is the best way I could say. Like, if you're a barbarian, you became a berserker because that was the type of barbarian you were. But there were also things like, you know, in the Forgotten Realms, you could take a Harper agent thing. And that's clearly something that's, you know, playing into the background of your character and how you're tied into the setting more than it is just specializing some of the bits of your class.
Yeah, it's definitely pointing at the direction your character is going narratively. We had, in the first Eberron campaign I played in, we had a player who very specifically took Dragonmark Air.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was a few levels of cleric, a couple of levels of rogue, and then Dragonmark Air. Very particular type of character that we still tease the player about today, but it was an interesting combination of things.
And what's interesting about that, too, is if that person didn't pick that prestige class from the beginning and make that part of their backstory, it's like, surprise, I am a Dragonmark Air.
Well, honestly, with prestige classes, you kind of had to plan for them.
Yeah.
You really had to, like, look at the prestige classes ahead of time and say, okay, I'm going to need X levels of this, Z levels of that, and I'm going to need these stats and these skills to be able to start using this prestige class. So if you didn't plan that out, by the time you got to the level you could have taken a prestige class, you probably weren't eligible.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the introduction of backgrounds in 5th edition. What did choosing a background give a character?
So all the stuff that they bundled into them were skills, tool proficiencies, languages, gear that had to do with that background, and there was an ability that was sort of a narrative permission to do a certain thing related to that background, and then personality traits, ideals, bonds, and flaws that were tailored to that background.
As you can gather from me talking about the first D&D game I ran where I kind of played with the tropes, I always really enjoyed kind of mixing up the class and the background. My very first character for 5th edition that I played for any length of time was a Tempest Cleric with the criminal background. It's fun to do those things.
Especially in 5th, it did kind of push you a little bit more to say, okay, how did this happen? Where did this come from? But I do like that because it gets away from that thing, if you look all the way back to Unearthed Arcana, where it was like, no, if you're going to be a cleric, you had to at least be a middle-class person that, you know, had this type of family.
Yep.
And nope, that's not what we're worrying about anymore.
Oh, I mean, we've had so many instances in my modern D&D era where we have characters who are of a certain class and do not have a skill that is expected to be part of that class. In the City of Cowl's game, our cleric does not have the religion skill. He was chosen by Cord to do some stuff. He doesn't know crap about religion. Meanwhile, our warlock, who's actually an Asimar angel on walkabout on Rumspringa, he has the religion skill. My sorcerer does not have arcana at all because she didn't train for this. She has the charlatan background. I technically should have mixed the charlatan and noble background because she was basically a princess on the run with a bard, you know, scamming people in villages as they traveled, but she doesn't have arcana. That's our rogue. Our rogue has arcana, you know, so we had all these skills covered, but because of the combination of backgrounds and classes that we put together, they weren't what the tropes would have had you believe.
It wasn't actually skills, but there was a thing that started up at the game store where this one player would always ask somebody that was playing a druid, "Do you have druidcraft as a cantrip?" No, you're not actually a druid. You can't be a druid unless you learn druidcraft as one of your cantrips.
So one of the things you mentioned that were part of backgrounds are personality traits, ideals, bonds, and flaws. How are these tied to a background? Because you wouldn't think they'd have to be, but they were always something that was kind of interwoven with the background.
It's interesting because 5th edition looked like it was trying to incorporate some stuff that came up through a lot of more narrative-focused RPGs and incorporate it.
Mm-hmm.
You can talk about how well they adopted some of these traits. But I, you know, the personality traits were, and all of those things were an example of that. Sometimes it kind of became like a stereotypical thing for that background. Like if you were a criminal, there would be, you know, things about your personality traits about whether or not you could resist stealing things from people or how you viewed wealth and things like that. The other thing that was interesting is they worked in some options that had like an alignment code in them. So it was like, if you took this one, this is what people that were evil usually took if they took this background. It wasn't that you couldn't take it if you weren't evil, but it was kind of that thing saying, if you want to edge that direction, you should probably pick this one.
And technically, these are all supposed to be tied to the GM granting inspiration.
Yes, which is interesting because my problem with it is if you look at a lot of the indie games and narrative-based games that this sort of mechanic came from, it is usually phrased as a yes-no question. It is sort of, did you encounter this and do this? And if yes, you award the inspiration. The problem is a lot of these traits were just written as a statement. So you had to stop and think about whether that statement applied. You know, there's something like, I don't like to try exotic food.
I have an issue with games that try and do this because it ties the GM granting a resource to the player based on something very specific to that character. And I can tell you, as a GM, even for just 4 players, I can't keep track of what is on each character sheet.
Yeah.
As a result, you end up with these resources that aren't handed out as often as they should be because, oh, the player actually, you know, without the player going, hey, look at me. I just did this thing that's on my sheet.
Mm-hmm.
Fate actually allows the GM to like force a player to lean into an aspect and give them a fate point for that. But in D&D, it was like, I appreciate that they added backgrounds to 5th edition. I think it did add some needed flavor, but I don't think the implementation quite got what they were going for.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, because inspiration, I can't keep track of each character's bonds or flaws or ideals to know when they've done something that deserves an inspiration point. Generally speaking, I give my players inspiration points at the beginning of the game. And, you know, maybe if they have a long rest, I'll give them another one if they've already used it. I make sure they have the resource, but I can't rely on giving them the resource based on the way the game says it should be given to them.
Even if you look at some of the games that that mechanic comes from, if you look at like a Powered by the Apocalypse game, a lot of that game could be you talking back and forth and then the player saying, okay, this move triggered, I should get whatever resource.
Yeah.
And that's how the game is played. In D&D, you could be in the middle of the fight and somebody could do something that triggers one of their ideals, but they're not going to stop and say that. And the GM's not going to stop and notice that, but it was something that did play into one of their ideals or something. So it gets missed and it doesn't get used for what it should get used for. And I also think people, especially if they've only played D&D, they aren't really geared towards saying, Mr. GM, please stop what you're doing right now. Can I have inspiration? Because blah, blah, blah. And explaining it, because then you're bringing everything to a stop to make sure you get your resource.
This is not to say that I think these things, personality traits, ideals, bonds, and flaws, were a bad thing, because I think they were great shorthand for how to roleplay the character. Especially running a one-shot, giving a player those and like having those in place gave the player an idea of who that character is and how to play them. But we don't have those anymore, do we?
We don't, actually.
Yeah, so let's talk about the changes that the 2024 rules have brought to backgrounds.
Backgrounds take up a lot less space now. So backgrounds now give you some of the same things they did. There'll be skills and tool proficiencies and language in there and some gear. You don't get the narrative permission to do something because now they give you a specific feat. And they also now, this is where they put ability score bonuses. So different backgrounds, they give you basically three different ability scores. And you can assign either one to each of those or 2-1 and 1 to the other.
They basically took those out of the species.
Yes.
You know, out of the race species and put them in the backgrounds instead. Which in theory, I like that.
In theory, yes. I spent some time, I actually put together a spreadsheet basically showing what backgrounds are most advantageous for each class. And I'm not real thrilled with how some of that turned out, because that thing that we used to have when people would say, as we were talking about before, your elf shouldn't be a sorcerer because they don't get a bonus to charisma, that's now in the backgrounds.
Optimal choices, again.
Yeah.
It's that balance between making a character that you find interesting the way you want to make them, but then also wanting to be effective. And realizing you're going to start at a handicap because you can't get your required stat to a certain level to start the game.
Yes.
Like, unless you can get that +1 to, you know, any of the spellcasting things, wisdom, intelligence, charisma, unless you can get that to 16 at the start of the game, you kind of hamstring yourself a little bit, and it takes a while to get caught up.
Just as an example, if you want to get strength and charisma, which are the things that you need as a paladin, you have entertainer or noble as your options. So now this brings us back to that Unearthed Arcana, where it's implying that every paladin, maybe not every paladin, because, you know, you can have people that take suboptimal stats and you can have people that were maybe wanted to be an entertainer and became a paladin, but you're going to have a lot of paladins that have that noble background. So now all of a sudden, paladins don't come from everywhere. They come from a narrow range of places.
Yeah.
And I'm not thrilled with that.
To be fair, I don't want to like tear apart the new rules, because there's some interesting things here that I like. I like that they put the stat bumps in the background rather than the species, but there isn't that flexibility, and there's nothing in the player's handbook that talks about how to build a background.
Yeah.
Which is probably going to be in the DMG.
The thing is, even with that, because the backgrounds are very thin, there's like the title of the background and a few paragraphs describing that background, and we don't have any of the personality traits, ideals, bonds, or flaws associated with it. If you have something in the DMG that's just saying make a background and decide what ability scores are associated with it and what feat, then it just starts to be like, okay, this can be anything, which is fine because it is asking you to come up with a background, but it also isn't helping you come up with a background.
I know when I get to the point of running a game in the 2024 rules, which is probably going to be a while, because I'm not going to change up the Depths of Zendrick game and Tales of the Valiant is the other game I want to try. So it'll be a while before I run the 2024 rules. But when I do get to that point, unless there's something completely magical and unexpected in the DMG for how to handle this, I'm probably going to tell my players, you let me know where you want your stat bumps.
Yeah.
We'll work out how that works for the background you're choosing. Because I get why they set up the backgrounds the way they did. But it took away that flexibility that would allow you to play with things a little bit.
Yeah, you could have the peasant hero that was inspired by the oath that they took to protect other people in their village becoming a paladin and taking that, you know, that folk hero background.
Yeah.
That didn't penalize them any.
Yep.
There is something interesting, though, with when we're talking about the personality traits, they now moved some of that, not in exactly the same form, into ability scores and alignment, because they have different traits under each alignment and under different ability scores based on whether you have them as high or low stats that are personality traits, which is a little weird to me.
It is a little weird.
I get the alignment one a little bit better than the ability scores.
There's a lot of variation there.
Yeah.
Well, let's take a moment and talk about how other current game systems are handling backgrounds. We're playing around with Tales of the Valiant.
Yeah, and something that I really do like about Tales of the Valiant is when they went away from race, they didn't make it one thing. It is now lineage and heritage. So you have your physical traits that you get, and then you have the culture that you're from, and you still get a background. And what I liked about this is when I'm looking at this, I did a thing where I converted my character that I'm playing in our actual play into 2024 and into Tales of the Valiant. And Tales of the Valiant was really cool because I could have a heritage that said I was from a small town and a background that said I was trained as a soldier. And now that whole, like, the culture is a little bit separate from the career that you might have had. And I really kind of like that because it adds an interesting bit of depth to it where it's in between those two things. And also the backgrounds in Tales of the Valiant, you know, they use the term talent is basically feats is what they use.
Yeah.
Each background has three that you can pick from. There's not one. And then the other thing that they do is they do not tie ability score bonuses to the background. They just added extra to the starting ability scores. You don't even add any bonuses to anything. It's just your standard array is higher or your number of points is higher to build the character in the first place.
And I believe you're not limited to 15 in D&D. If you're doing point buy, the maximum you're allowed to buy is a 15. Mm-hmm. And then you have to have, in 2014 version, a racial stat bump to get it above that. Or in the 2024 version, a background stat bump to get it above that.
And I think one of the standard array ability scores is 16. You know, it's just saying, yeah, we know.
You know, and I know that there's a lot of people out there who are like, well, you don't have to have maximum stats. You don't have to be min-maxed to have everything. And I get it. You can play what you want, but there is a degree of competency and functionality in the rules to have certain things be certain ways. And if you are a spellcasting class, your spell save DC is based on your stat.
Yeah.
And if your stat is only a 15, that means your spell save DC is, I think, what, 12?
Mm-hmm.
And that's not hard to beat.
Yeah, definitely. And it's even rougher if you are something like a paladin or a ranger, where you have to worry about your combat stat and also your casting stat. So if you're not getting a bonus somewhere, you're not going to have a decent one or the other.
Yeah. So what are some of the other games that are doing stuff with backgrounds?
Level Up Advanced 5e, which is what EN Publishing put out, which is interesting because they got started on this before the OGL debacle started. So they had a head start on all of this. But they have things broken out into heritage, culture, background, which is very similar to Tales of the Valiant, but they also add destiny. And that's basically a way at the beginning for you to say, this is the type of character I want to play. It's, again, getting into that whole, this is the archetype. I may not be this yet, but this is what I want to be.
Like 4th edition's Epic Destinies.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's very similar, and it also does that same thing where you can get a little bit more about my culture says this, but I was also this specific thing within the culture when you pick the background.
Right.
And I like that too. There were some backgrounds that Arcanum Worlds, which Arcanum Worlds is a third party publisher that was made up of people that used to work at BioWare and worked on the first Baldur's Gate game. And they started doing some RPG products. And in their products, they included epic paths instead of backgrounds. And what epic paths were is basically saying, this is your destiny as a hero. But those are tied specifically to the adventures they put out. So it, you know, when you encounter this thing, that is what triggers this thing in your epic destiny, which is a neat way to tailor somebody to the adventure, but it's not super flexible to use outside of that adventure. And it's real hard to do if you're a DM planning a campaign, because I do not plan 20 levels of a campaign.
Yeah, you're lucky if I've planned the level you're on.
I also wanted to bring up, this was in the playtest rules for 5th edition, and it is in the Dungeon Master's Guide, which is, it is backgrounds as a skill, but you rate these things as a die.
Oh.
At first level, when your proficiency bonus would be +2, you're rolling a d4 and adding the d4 to your d20. If you have expertise in something, you would roll 2d4s and pick the better one. And it goes up to where basically the die can go anywhere from 1 to like double what your proficiency bonus would be. So by the time you're 20th level, you're rolling a d12 for your proficiency die. It's interesting. I kind of want to try it, but I don't know, because if it really doesn't work, I don't want to throw everything off for the night.
It's interesting, but I can also see it getting in the way of things.
Yes. But I mean, the way that works is you would say, you know, I was raised as somebody that was always going to be part of the Thieves Guild. So now everything that is Thieves Guild related, you get to use your proficiency die on. Which kind of brings us to some other games that are less directly 5e, like 13th Age, where your backgrounds are basically skills. You have a certain number of points that you put into a background that you describe, and anytime that background would apply, you get to roll that bonus that you have attributed to that background. I like this. This is kind of cool. It does lead to some people really stretching what they may have done in that background before. But also, that's something that Daggerheart has been doing too, the Darrington Press Critical Role thing. In that, it's not so much your background, but you have like a past experience that you detail. And that past experience you can use sometimes as a bonus to your die roll because it's relevant.
We did a playtest of Daggerheart with our editor, Chris Snezak. And I had a lot of fun with the character creation on that one because it created some interesting ideas for who my character was and where she came from. Let's wrap this up. Ultimately, the question is, what are the ways we as GMs use these backgrounds that our players choose, and how can we help our players do interesting stuff with the backgrounds to make their characters more exciting?
I think the main thing is you need to be on the same page with somebody about what their background means. Like, if you're a folk hero, does that mean you did something momentous while you're still first level that still follows you around? Or does it mean you want to be this thing and you did a few things that would be folk hero-ish, but you're not that yet?
Yeah.
So that's one thing, is just clarifying, what does this background mean to you?
I think it's important for you as a GM to be aware of the backgrounds of your players' characters and kind of lean into them when necessary. You know, because it's very easy for them to just kind of get shuffled off to the side and ignored in the background. But it can be really fun to lean into them.
Mm-hmm.
What is their history? Where are they from? In the City of Cowl's game, all of our backgrounds have kind of come into play in one way or another as the GM built up the world around us. Admittedly, that's a long-running campaign. He's had time to develop this stuff over the years that we've been playing this campaign. But, you know, it's still something that he put effort into helping craft to tie into those backgrounds.
I think if there's anything in the background that implies that you have a connection to an NPC or some kind of contact, you need to flesh that out.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things I've liked in our Marody game, is not only did I give you a few contacts, but also Marin has three people that work for him that I have as I have a cook, and I have the person that, you know, helps dress him, and his scribe. And I absolutely love playing those three characters in the background.
I mean, I believe his background is noble.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it makes sense.
Mm-hmm. It is very difficult to keep track of all of the things that 5th edition backgrounds give you when it comes to the flaws and the all of that. But knowing what the background means to your players should not be as hard to keep track of. The other thing that I would recommend is something I've tried to do with some campaigns, and that is come up with questions about the campaign or the region that you're playing in that are similar to each one of those things. What is a personality trait that somehow ties into this region or this type of campaign? What kind of ideal do you have that ties into this campaign? Frame that as a question. And even if you're not going to keep track of it as a GM, it is giving the player an idea of what the campaign is about and getting them to detail their characters in a way that ties into the campaign that way.
Backgrounds are the ways for you to help figure out the place your PCs hold in the world, which is important for you as a GM to craft adventures for those characters that matter. Yeah, you can totally do a beer and pretzels game where I don't care what your background is. We're here to go through this dungeon. You know, that's totally a valid way to play D&D, but that's not the only way to play D&D. You can also craft some really compelling stories with the characters your players bring to the table.
Mm-hmm.
And some of that can be done through the background.
Clacto. Burrata. Necktie. Nectar. Nickel. It was definitely an N-word.
This is your Eldritch Invocation. I'm Chris, your editor and EMS for Heroes of Hollis Way. We have a Patreon. On our Patreon, you can get a couple of PDFs a month, one of them having to do with the Heroes of Hollis Way, one of them having to do with spells that we are working on for an alternate spellbook for D&D and other 5th edition games. There's also other content that comes out on that Patreon. Often Jerry will put together something and I will lay it out. You also get the GM's Hovel. That's me talking about the most recent episode of the Heroes of Hollis Way and what I was thinking when I was making choices during the game. That comes out a week after the episode. If you want, you can also just come join our Discord. There is no cost for that, but you can get in on the conversation and see the things that we are doing. You'll see our Patreon stuff, you'll see our YouTube stuff, our shorts and things that we release, and you can get in on the topic of the week and all the conversations that come along with that for different fantasy role-playing games. So if nothing else, come join our Discord, come talk to us. There will be links for both of those in the show notes.
Time for rest, you two. Get on with your downtime research.
Every episode, we're going to look for something related to D&D that we want to pass along to our listeners. It might be products, websites, videos, or podcasts, but it will always be something that we think will enhance your D&D experience.
In addition to our Patreon and our Discord, did you know we also have a YouTube channel? I mean, it's me. I'm bringing you a YouTube channel to check out. In addition to hosting our episodes, it also hosts a ton of fantastic shorts that Chris has been crafting out of our episodes. I love these so much because they're little shorts he pulls out. You've got an animated Ange head and an animated Jared head as the clip goes, and like they're our best bits. I really love this.
And every once in a while, they're a bit that gets edited out that he saves for those.
Yes. There are some outtakes in there. There will be a link to this in the show notes. I think these are awesome, and I would love it if they could get out to more people. So go give the channel a subscribe and give some shorts a like if you like them.
We kept doing this disclaimer where we're like, we're not necessarily going to do crowdfunding because it's hard to get the timing right, and yet we keep doing crowdfunding. So I think this thing that I'm going to be mentioning, you should probably have about 2 weeks left to back it by the time this show drops. It is called Shadow City Mysteries. It is a noir 5e setting. It is basically a clockwork noir setting. So in other words, it is sort of like a 40s detective novel, but also it is using like more clockpunk style technology in that setting. The entire world is black and white. Like, it is literally black and white in this world because all of the color drained out of it at one point in time. There are 6 factions, and your characters basically solve mysteries and go and, you know, resolve cases. And it ends up that you trip over larger and more dangerous conspiracies as you go along and you investigate these things. And there's going to be 6 new classes. They're all lower magic, but I don't want to quite say it's like Eberron because it's not quite like that, but it is a magical setting but people don't have a lot of magic when they have magic. The emphasis, there's going to be bits in every one of the character classes that actually ties into investigation and resolving mysteries, so that you don't take a class that's like, I'm not good at this. And I am really interested to see how this turns out. And as I said, it's on BackerKit. We'll have the link in the show notes. And you should probably still have 2 weeks left by the time this thing drops.
Heading on out of here, we are happily part of the Polygamers Podcast Network, helping you run and play your best games. We think you'll enjoy another Polygamers podcast like...
The Gnomecast. Several gnomes from Gnome Stew get together and talk about gaming topics and themselves in an effort to entertain you and avoid being thrown in the stew.
We've used up all of our resources, so I think it's time for a long rest. I hope this adventure was rewarding for you, and we hope you'll go exploring with us when we start our next adventure.